You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Let me introduce you in return to Michelle. She would be undoubtedly too modest to fully highlight all of her achievements, so I will do it for her. She is a graduate of Harvard College, magna cum laude, and got her JD with distinction from the Stanford Law School. After law school, she was a law clerk with Honorable Robert F. Peckham, Chief Judge of the Northern District of California. She spent 3 years as a litigation associate in New York with the firm of Debevoise & Plimpton. She then moved on to become an assistant U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of New York, which, for those of you who are not New Yorkers, is Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, and Long Island. She served there until 2001. And from 1997 to 1999, she was deputy chief of the narcotics unit. So she is not aware of the problems of the criminal law. In that context, she conducted numerous jury trials, investigated and prosecuted cases ranging from narcotics, racketeering, homicide, kidnapping, weapons violations, money laundering, and fraud, and has worked closely with the FBI, the DEA, ATF, U.S. Customs, NYPD, and other law enforcement agencies. After leaving the U.S. Attorney's Office, Professor Martinez-Campbell took a I won't say detour, but actually actualized something that many of us only fantasize about, which is she became a published and quite successful novelist particularly in the crime and mystery genre. Her heroine in these books was a federal prosecutor. There we are. She has, I think, is it five novels?
Four novels published. There is a fifth, but it's sitting in a drawer waiting to be edited.
Okay. So. Anyway, you can get further details on that if you go to michellemartinez.com. You can find out about her life as a novelist.
No obligation to do that.
She moved up to the Upper Valley area of New Hampshire and Vermont, and we at the Vermont Law School were lucky enough to entice her into teaching. She discovered she rather liked it, and so she is becoming a full-time professor with us starting this fall. And we are looking forward to benefiting from her knowledge on many, many fronts as we go forward. I give you Michelle Martinez-Campbell, who's going to talk to us about The Kids Are Online, the Internet, the Commerce Clause, and the amended Federal Kidnapping Act.
Well, thank you very much, Oliver. Thank you for that introduction, and thank you to the Berkman Center for hosting me. I'm delighted to be here and talk to you about my article, which is going to be coming out in the University of Pennsylvania Journal of Constitutional Law this fall. This article looks at the constitutionality of a 2006 amendment to the federal kidnapping statute, which expanded federal jurisdiction. Now, many crimes, and given your eclectic backgrounds, I'm going to assume that you don't really know the nitty-gritty of federal criminal jurisdiction. So many crimes have both federal and state law analogs. The vast majority of crime gets prosecuted at the state level rather than the federal level. And the same crime may be punishable by both the federal government and the states, but in order to be punishable by the federal government, there needs to be a specialized federal interest or jurisdictional hook. Prior to 2006, when this amendment was made, in order for a kidnapping to be prosecuted federally, the most common jurisdictional hook was that the victim was transported across the border of a state. So, in other words, that more than one state was involved in the crime. In 2006, and I'm going to talk about this in a little more detail in a minute, the Adam Walsh Act, which is a big law that was focused on internet child predation, changed federal kidnapping jurisdiction so that use of the internet or other telecommunications facilities or other interstate commerce facilities, which is a term of art under Commerce Clause jurisdiction, if those were used in the commission of the crime in some sort of central, meaningful way, then the crime could be prosecuted by the federal government as opposed to just the states. Now, this may sound like a relatively narrow topic, but it's actually quite a big and important topic because it deals with, you know, critical issues of the power of the federal government versus the state in the criminal law area, and does so under the rubric of the Commerce Clause, which has been extremely controversial in recent years and is essentially, you know, the same question that we ask when we ask whether the federal government can promulgate health care legislation or environmental regulations. You know, we're talking about what sort of power does the federal government have to come in and regulate certain areas as opposed to the state government. So this article looks at that issue. It also looks more specifically and more of interest to this group at the question of what role does the internet play and other telecommunications facilities play in creating federal jurisdiction over crimes where there might not otherwise be federal jurisdiction. And the bottom line answer to that question is that in a number of different areas, use of the internet in a crime can transform that criminal act from a state crime into a federal crime, with all of the consequences that go with that, including in many instances, as I'm sure our defense lawyer could tell you, stiffer sentences and, you know, a sort of a more hard-edged prosecution. In addition, there are also implications to this issue for questions about internet regulation, more broadly speaking, and what is best for the health and the growth and the openness of the internet, federal jurisdiction, state jurisdiction, et cetera, because we're not really talking about not criminalizing these uses of the internet. We're talking about who should be the appropriate authority. So, those are the sorts of questions that are raised by this amendment. And my view generally, the position that I advocate in the article, is that federal authority and federal jurisdiction is the appropriate outcome on a number of levels. First of all, in terms of constitutional law and Supreme Court doctrine under the Commerce Clause, this is appropriately an area of federal concern and federal jurisdiction. Secondly, as a matter of law enforcement policy, when we talk about what resources are needed to investigate these types of crimes, how are they best enforced, and so forth. And finally, as a matter of policy regarding the internet, in the sense that we don't want to see a patchwork of state crimes. We'd rather see one sort of unified system which would promote consistency and sort of certainty for all the players involved. So that, sort of generally speaking, is the topic of the article. Now, let me sort of drill down a little bit into the specifics of the amendment. First of all, as I mentioned, this amendment was made by the Adam Walsh Act, which was enacted in 2006. And I know some of you are probably familiar with it because I know of the interest of the center generally in issues of youth and media. And this was the big congressional attempt to deal with issues of child predation and the internet. And it was named after Adam Walsh, who's the son of John Walsh from America's Most Wanted. So named after this famous child crime victim who was, you know, abducted from a shopping mall when he was 6 years old and murdered in the most horrific way. And, you know, this law arose at a time when there was a great deal of public focus and fear, frankly, around issues of child predation online. And certainly, you know, I'm sympathetic to the idea that some of this was born out of political pressure and that, you know, we have to be careful not to vilify any particular technology. Technology is simply a means to an end for the perpetrators of the crimes as much as weapons are or whatever, and that we want to make sure that the ways in which we approach enforcement issues is not in any way burdening a technology that obviously needs to continue to grow for the betterment of, you know, society at large, the economy, et cetera. But clearly the Adam Walsh Act arose in this context, and it's very clear In the legislative history, the preamble to the act states it very clearly that it was an act to protect children from sexual exploitation and violent crime and to promote internet safety. So that was essentially Congress, the federal government, staking its claim to jurisdiction in this area and saying, here's our federal interest. We want to promote internet safety. It's not just that we are concerned about the victimization of children, but we are concerned about the victimization using this particular technology, which is of interest to the central federal government. And, you know, this act contained numerous provisions. It set up federal sex offender registration, federal sex offender civil commitment laws, and federalized a number of sex crimes. In particular, it closed a lot of gaps in the laws and expanded jurisdiction in a number of areas, including in the kidnapping area, if the internet or other telecommunications facilities was involved. So let's just take a look at the particular amendment I'm concerned with, which was contained in Title II of the Adam Walsh Act, amended the Federal Kidnapping Act, and included this new language. So whoever essentially commits a kidnapping, unlawfully seizes, confines, inveigles, decoys, kidnaps, abducts, or carries away any person, when the offender uses, and then they talk about facilities or instrumentalities of interstate commerce in committing or in furtherance of the commission of the offense. And now that sort of broad-based term, interstate commerce facility or instrumentality, is what we're talking about here. So it is the use of that facility or instrumentality that creates the jurisdiction that is the new addition to the federal kidnapping statute that we're concerned with. Now, more practically, what does that mean? It means that you can now commit a kidnapping within the borders of a single state, never leave the state of Massachusetts, never leave the state of Vermont. But if an interstate commerce facility, you know, properly defined, is used in commission of the crime, that will now be prosecutable by the federal government in addition to or as opposed to the states. And you know, it is concurrent jurisdiction. I'm not going to get into sort of all of the details about how you decide whether it should be prosecuted federally. But what this means is it can be prosecuted federally, whereas before it could not. And there are cases like this, not so many yet, because we're talking about a relatively narrow slice of cases, but a few that have made their way through the federal courts. There's one in particular that occurred within the state of Vermont that is a case study in my article and is sort of piqued my interest, frankly, in this issue, in which the crime occurred completely within the borders of Vermont, but the internet and text messaging using the telephone were absolutely critical to execution of the crime. And that's a case involving a man named Michael Jakes, who was a registered sex offender, and he kidnapped, drugged, raped, and murdered his step-niece, who was 12 years old at the time. And the internet and text messaging were absolutely central to the planning and execution. He used numerous emails to convince his stepdaughter that she was being targeted by this sort of shadowy criminal organization, and he had been molesting her for a number of years, and he therefore was able to use her to lure the victim to his home. And in addition, the whole kind of basis for the victim coming to his house was that she was made to believe that a boy she liked would be there, and that was done through the use of emails and text messages, which were dummied up to look like they were coming from this boy. So it was really the internet and text messaging and the anonymity that they conferred that allowed him to lure this girl to the kidnapping. And you can see this in the text of the indictment. The jurisdictional hook is absolutely sort of front and center there. And they talk about how Jakes unlawfully kidnapped Brooke Bennett and used means, facilities, and instrumentalities of interstate commerce, namely cell phone text messages, internet email messages, and internet MySpace posting in committing or in furtherance of the commission of the offense. So we see that the federal nature of the jurisdiction is central to the prosecution, and it needs to be alleged in the indictment, and then it needs to get proved up at the trial. And again, the whole crime took place in one house in Vermont. There was no interstate transport whatsoever. Now, the fact that this can now be prosecuted federally has enormous consequences to the defendant. And here in particular, because Vermont has no death penalty and the federal government does, so the defendant is now charged in a capital murder case, essentially, although it's charged as a kidnapping resulting in death, but he can now face the death penalty, whereas he wouldn't before the 2006 amendment. Because of that, his lawyers, well, not necessarily just because of that, but his lawyers have challenged the federal jurisdiction, and in particular, they've challenged the amendment to the statute. And that brings us to our bigger federalism issue. And I know only a few of you are law students or lawyers, or some of you are, but some aren't. So I'm going to talk sort of at a kind of basic level here about the Supreme Court jurisprudence that's involved and about the Commerce Clause issue. So now, this issue, the challenge to the amendment, arises under the Commerce Clause, strangely enough, for those of you who aren't familiar with constitutional law, because there is no police power in the United States Constitution that is conferred on the federal government. So, you know, our government is a government of enumerated powers. If the Constitution doesn't say that the federal government can do something specifically, then they can't do it. But there are certain portions of the Constitution that are relatively broad that then get sort of called into service in other areas. And so the Commerce Clause has been traditionally the source of all federal criminal law. There is no police power. So we turn to the Commerce Clause, which says that Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations among the several states and with the Indian tribes. And the interstate portion of the Commerce Clause is particularly what we're concerned with here. So like every other federal criminal law, the kidnapping statute is an exercise of Congress's commerce power as opposed to its police power, and it has to be justified as an appropriate exercise of the commerce power in order for federal criminal laws to be sustained when they are challenged. So Michael Jakes and several other defendants around the country have raised Commerce Clause challenges to this amendment to the Federal Kidnapping Act. Now, a number of, you know, years ago, this would not have been an issue. For much of the 20th century, federal criminal jurisdiction was not controversial. And, you know, most crimes, many violent crimes, had both state law and federal law analogs, and that was rarely challenged. If it was challenged, it generally was upheld. So, for example, robbery is a state crime. The robbery of a federally insured bank is a federal crime. Fraud is a state crime. Wire fraud committed using the telephone or internet or whatever is a federal crime. And that was quite uncontroversial for a number of years. But as we sort of saw the bench becoming increasingly conservative and the Supreme Court being more focused on issues of states' rights versus the power of the federal government, this began to change. And in 1995, Chief Justice Rehnquist issued an opinion in the case of United States versus Lopez, which has really become sort of the cornerstone of what we might call modern federalism. And it began to look more carefully at issues of federal versus state power, particularly in the criminal law area. This case involved the Gun-Free School Zones Act, which was what would have been previously a somewhat uncontroversial law which penalized carrying guns in a school zone, the defendant in that case challenged it as being beyond Congress's commerce power and argued essentially there was nothing economic or commercial about the crime of carrying a gun in a school zone. And the Supreme Court ended up agreeing with the defendant in that case and striking down the law. And in doing so, they took all of Commerce Clause jurisprudence up to that point, and Chief Justice Rehnquist boiled it down into these three categories that have become famous as, you know, the three Lopez categories under which Congress may properly regulate in the criminal law area and really all areas. So first, Congress may regulate the use of the channels of interstate commerce, and that would be things like the roads. In fact, it has occasionally been held that the internet is a channel of interstate commerce. Second, Congress is empowered to regulate and protect the instrumentalities of interstate commerce, even though the threat may come only from intrastate activities. And this is the portion of Lopez that has most commonly been applied to the internet. So the idea is that if something is criminalized based on use of the internet is a facility of interstate commerce, like telephones, like ATM machines, you know, something, it is sort of an instrument that allows commerce to carry on, so it is properly subject to federal regulation. And then third, and this is sort of the catch-all category, Congress has the power to regulate activities that have a substantial relation to interstate commerce. And in that category, the Supreme Court put this Gun-Free School Zones Act and said, in order to have a substantial relation to interstate commerce, essentially a crime needs to be economic in nature, and carrying a gun is not economic in nature, and so they struck down the law. Now, you would think that because of Lopez's second category, allowing federal jurisdiction where instrumentalities of commerce are used, that it would be uncontroversial and that it would not sort of lead to challenge to say that the use of the internet in a kidnapping is an appropriate exercise of federal jurisdiction. But that has not been the case, largely because federalists and states' rights advocates have taken the view that the economic versus non-economic distinction that is really that comes up in Lopez's third category should really just apply across the board, and that you should sort of add on, even if an instrumentality of commerce is used, you should ask, is a crime economic or non-economic before you allow it to be prosecuted by the feds? And so the argument that a number of lawyers have made relating to this particular amendment that I'm talking about is that this is a violent crime, it's not an economic crime, and even though an instrumentality is used, it's still in violation of the commerce power. So that challenge was raised in the Jakes case, and it's also been raised in a number of, really only a couple of other cases around the country. And so far, it has only been addressed at the federal district court, or that's the trial court level, and has not yet made it to any courts of appeal or to the Supreme Court, although it may well be heading there. And so far, the three courts that have addressed this issue have found that as a matter of Commerce Clause jurisprudence, it's proper to allow jurisdiction based on use of the internet because it falls into the second category of Lopez, and that's something that the Supreme Court has carved out. So far, this has always been upheld. Now I want to just talk a little bit more about the internet aspect of this and sort of what it means for the internet before I sort of throw it out to you all for questions and thoughts. As I said, my view is that the proper outcome to this controversy is that federal jurisdiction is the right way to go, and I've really just explained why, as a matter of Commerce Clause jurisprudence, that's true. But let's talk about it as a matter of internet policy and law enforcement policy for a moment. First of all, the alternative here is not failure to criminalize the conduct because, you know, we're talking generally about serious crimes against children. It's something that needs to and would be, in any event, redressed at the state level if it was not being prosecuted at the federal level. So the question, the better question to ask is, does it make more sense to address these crimes at the federal level versus the state level? And I think there are a couple of reasons why it really makes more sense to address it at the federal level. The first has to do with law enforcement resources and expertise. And, you know, Oliver mentioned my background as an AUSA. As somebody who did a lot of narcotics cases, I spent the vast majority of my time doing wiretaps and other sorts of electronic surveillance. And, you know, that's something that the federal government and federal law enforcement agencies do day in and day out, and I think have a great sensitivity to. I'm not saying this has always been true, but it was true during the Clinton administration, and I think it's true again now, a sensitivity to sort of Fourth Amendment issues that come up, and they know how to do this stuff. They have the resources to do it. They're trained to do it, and I think it's generally done in a way that appropriately tracks Fourth Amendment and other law. That is not necessarily as true at the state level. Many states lack all resources to do any sort of electronic investigations, and they certainly lack the kind of expertise that you get at the federal level. But secondly, as a matter of internet policy, it really makes the most sense to have this just sort of all done in one shop, essentially. And I should just drop a footnote here and say that the internet has been held by every court that's ever addressed this to be an interstate commerce facility, you know, as defined in Commerce Clause law. That's never been decided by the Supreme Court. Sort of surprisingly hasn't made it up that far, but a number of courts of appeals have held that the internet is an interstate commerce facility. And in doing so, they've talked at great length about the nature of the internet as an economic tool, as sort of a place and sort of what its characteristics are, almost at a philosophical level. There's been some interesting stuff sort of discussed about that. Even early on, like in the mid-90s when this was first coming up, you know, courts would focus on the idea that the internet is borderless. It cannot be confined within the jurisdiction of a single state. Even internet communications that look like they're taking place, you know, between two people in the same building may involve servers that are out of state and may actually, you know, physically involve crossing state lines. And because of that, the courts have held that this really needs to be regulated at the federal level when we're talking about crime. So I'm just going to end with a quote from a Second Circuit Court of Appeals case from 2003 that looked at the constitutionality of a Vermont law that criminalized sending pornographic images to minors. And the issue that was raised here was whether it was constitutional to allow Vermont, in particular, to regulate the sending of these images over the internet. And the court found that it was not, and they found that it violated something called the Dormant or Negative Commerce Clause, which is sort of implied in the Commerce Clause and says that just like you need to have federal authority in order to regulate commerce, the states can't make laws that burden the commerce of other states. So the court held that, and I'll just quote it here, at the same time that the internet's geographic reach increases Vermont's interest in regulating out-of-state conduct, it makes state regulation impracticable. We think it likely that the internet will soon be seen as falling within the class of subjects that are protected from state regulation because they imperatively demand a single uniform rule. So just to quickly sum up, I think that, you know, there's real logic to that. And I think that as a matter of internet policy, law enforcement policy, and Supreme Court doctrine, it makes sense to have crimes that are committed with you know, central or heavy internet use be prosecuted at the federal level rather than the state level. And so with that, I'd like to throw it open to you and hear what you think about that. Yes.
So you talked about the internet, and the preamble to the Walsh Act talks about the internet. But the wording of the Walsh Act seems to apply to every kidnapping except for the ones conducted by bullhorns.
Okay,
and,
well,
you know, at least from old-time TV shows, it seems they always call in over the telephone the drop and the demand. So doesn't that actually federalize pretty much every kidnapping?
Okay, well, that's a great question, and it's obviously it's one of the arguments that's raised by states' rights advocates who say because there is a potential slippery slope problem here and a potential problem with infinite jurisdiction, that this must not happen. And I think the answer to that comes up in the slide I showed you earlier. Of the indictment, where in order to prosecute federally, you need to prove that the internet was used in commission of the offense or in furtherance of commission of the offense. You need to charge that. And if you look at jury instructions, you need to prove it and instruct the jury that it has to be used in furtherance of or in commission of the offense. And as a matter of kind of trial practice and policy, and also as a matter of the federal district courts that have looked at this, they've required some central connection between the use of the internet and the crime. Calling in a ransom demand would be enough. But ordering a pizza during the course of the kidnapping would not. Okay, so we're not talking about infinite jurisdiction. We're talking about some centralized kind of usage that is integral to the crime. You know, part of the reason there is that you, in order to be able to prove that, you probably need to, you know, get telephone records, get potentially wiretap type evidence, and again, that sort of brings up the federal law enforcement issue. Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me that we've already got wire fraud on the books, and it's pretty well established as constitutional. And I wonder how any court could invalidate this law either on its face or an application. I would guess they'd have to do it in application if it's reciting what Lopez said, and then you'd have to say, well, maybe this is or isn't an instrumentality. But I wonder how great the danger is that this law couldn't be invalidated, given that wire fraud's on the books. And could a court distinguish the wire fraud offense from this?
Well, certainly the three courts that have looked at this so far have talked about the idea that if you were to invalidate this, you would be calling into question similar jurisdictional hooks in a number of other statutes. You know, wire fraud is one, but other major ones that they talk about are murder for hire. Normally murder is a state law crime, but if you use the telephone or the internet to contract a murder, that becomes a federal crime. So that's probably the most closely analogous to the Kidnapping Act statute. And courts have looked at that, and they have been concerned with the effect of invalidating this statute in terms of a sort of contagion to other federal statutes. So that's very true. It's also true, and this gets back to your question, that you can make both a facial challenge to the statute and an as-applied challenge to the application in the particular case. And that is commonly done. So every case that I've seen, and again, there have only been three that have actually been resolved at this point, every case that I've seen made both a facial challenge to the constitutionality of the statute under the Commerce Clause, and then separately argued that even if the court upheld the statute, you would need to look at the facts of the particular case and ask whether the usage of the internet was central enough. And that's where you get courts actually diving into the facts and saying, we want some sort of central, meaningful non-frivolous usage in order to see the statute applied. And courts have actually done that.
I want to bring up one argument you made, which I think was kind of a practical argument in favor of the statute, namely, the federal government's better equipped to handle the crimes. But isn't that true of pretty much every crime? Federal government's better equipped to prosecute every crime? And isn't it more an argument in favor of having states become better equipped? And furthermore, there's three questions, I guess. And then the third question is, not my own question, but someone who's states' rights advocate might say, why twist the Constitution for something that is practically better now? Why not make the states practically better at doing this and save the Constitution? Because that's the main question.
Okay, very interesting question. But I think I disagree with your premise. First of all, I do think that there are many crimes for which the state is already equally or better able to prosecute. And that would be your sort of garden variety violent crimes that take place in the local jurisdiction that don't involve any sort of electronic or technological components, in which local police might have better connections, better rapport, better ability to go in and investigate than bringing in, you know, the FBI from, the Burlington office to some little town in Vermont. So I do think that for local crimes, generally speaking, local prosecution is not only adequate, but in many instances preferable. Secondly, the problem with increasing state resources is that it's really expensive. DEA and FBI a limited number of other federal agencies have already invested in the equipment and training that's necessary to do electronically based investigations. And to say that we should bring those resources down to the state level, when really we're talking about a small slice of crimes here, not the vast majority of crimes, I think would be an inefficient use of resources. And I should just mention here that currently the statistics for federal versus state prosecution of crime is something like 5% federal to 95% state and local. So what we're really talking about small, these sort of expert prosecutions that are dealing with the most serious crimes. And then you made one final question, which is why twist the Constitution? And again, my argument is that it's not a twisting of the Constitution, but that this is clearly appropriately Lopez's second category and that the Supreme Court has validated that. Yeah.
Just to stay with part of that question for a second, the idea that the feds are better at electronic investigations, I think that's probably true. But I wonder about the premise that this really is a very narrow set, very small number of crimes. If you look across the board, the internet and cell phones and other technology are being used in pretty much every kind of crime you can think in an increasing variety. It's not that unusual now to see robbery cases, fraud, I mean, you name it. The internet is such a ubiquitous part of life that people are using it. And so electronic evidence is going to form some part of the evidence in the case. So I wonder how easy it is to draw that line and say, really, it's only this narrow set of internet-facilitated kidnapping cases where we want that expertise, when really you could make the same argument for a whole bunch of what we otherwise think of as state crimes. And so how do we draw the line and say, okay, it's appropriate here when the internet's used for these, but even though the internet's being used more and more and more in all these other kind of crimes, it wouldn't be practical, it wouldn't be sort of appropriate as a resource matter to do it in those. How do you distinguish?
Well, that's really the big question. I think you've put your finger right on it, because the dormant Commerce Clause argument could be applied to a number of other areas. And I think you're absolutely right about that. Here, I do think what distinguishes this particular amendment is the focus on child safety. And why is that more sort of pertinent in these types of cases? I think it's because of the anonymity that you get from the internet that particularly allows this sort of child victimization to take place. You know, kids are online and on their devices all the time. I know I have two tween kids, and they cannot be separated from their devices. And parental monitoring of that, even with, you know, web nanny and other sort of devices, is very difficult. So you're putting children in a position where they can be contacted in an anonymous way that parents don't have supervision of. And just as, you know, I think that that creates a federal interest in terms of the Federal Kidnapping Act and the Adam Walsh Act, I think it's a problem that that is not as specific, say, to the robbery context or, you know, a sort of broad range of contexts. But I also think you make a good point, Oliver.
I get that interest, but if that were really the motivation, then you could see an argument that this statute should be written to cover only child kidnappings,
mm-hmm.
and not to cover adult kidnappings, because that seems to fall outside, and yet it doesn't. It's written to cover all.
Yes, that's true, and it has been used in non-child kidnapping cases, so that of the three cases I mentioned that have been looked at so far by federal courts, the Brooke Bennett case is the only one that actually involves a child victim. The other two involved, one in particular I remember, a real estate agent was repeatedly contacted online and by telephone to come to a showing at which she was, assaulted and robbed. That sort of luring was considered to be enough. I think you raise a valid point, and I don't really have the definitive answer to it, other than maybe to get back to this issue of sort of inconsistent regulation. And you may be talking about certain crimes pose that problem more than others do. Yes.
I guess I just want to ask a question about clarifying. So you've been sort of using, I mean, I know in the beginning of the talk you talked about the internet, but you've been sort of using that interchangeably with phone calls and text messages. And I'm wondering if the constitutional challenges, like the Commerce Clause stuff, has to specifically do with like email and MySpace, or if it's sort of the broader like cell phones, email.
It does apply more broadly to all telecommunications facilities, and that has been true generally in Commerce Clause jurisdiction, and it's also true in the way the criminal statutes are written. So, for example, in murder for hire cases, it does not specifically have to be the internet. That was the focus of the Adam Walsh Act concern, but the statutory language includes telephone and so forth, and I think they pose similar issues and problems. Yeah.
Into that, suppose we go back 25 years before most people were using either the internet or cell phones, and this crime had been committed solely by making telephone calls within the state of Vermont that didn't go outside of Vermont. And back then, the signal probably wouldn't have been transmitted outside of Vermont to get from my phone to your phone. Would there still have been proper federal jurisdiction then?
After the Adam Walsh Act, the answer to that question is yes, because the vast majority of the federal courts that have looked at the issue of whether a telephone call needs to cross state lines in order to make it sort of an interstate commerce issue have said that it does not. And this has come up mainly in the context of the murder for hire statute, with the idea that what we're really deciding is that telephones are facilities of interstate commerce. We don't need to look at particular individual calls, because if you're using the telephone, you are using an interstate commerce facility. And just to kind of get back to... Well,
sorry,
that's
too,
correct,
but that's,
and, channels, it's not. And that sort of gets into an overlay that I'm not really addressing directly, which is how do federal prosecutors decide that because they could take jurisdiction, they should? And there are all sorts of sort of policy statements and guidelines that come into play there. And that is sort of an interesting, more detailed, separate question. There are many cases in which the federal government would have jurisdiction but declines to prosecute in favor of a state prosecution because the federal interest on the particular facts presented is not considered to be sufficient.
I-89, even within the state of Vermont, that's enough for it to be federal jurisdiction.
Not in the kidnapping cases I've looked at. Now, where you do see the first category or channels getting used is where you not only drove on I-89, but you crossed the border from Vermont to Massachusetts. I mean,
that would definitely be interstate crime at that point.
Yes, but that is simply a first category channels case. I mean, a state border crossing is a first category issue. And that is a very traditional jurisdictional hook that nobody seems to have any problems with. So the idea that you crossed a road from one state to another has always been enough, you know. So the question is, how is it different if you instead your digital self crossed a state border, you know? Yeah.
I want to preface this with, I don't have a background in law, and it's entirely possible that my understanding is sort of overly shaped by anecdotal, you know, mainstream reporting or whatever. But so it's my understanding that that the war on drugs and a lot of drug, the idea that federal courts have jurisdiction over drug crimes has a lot to do with the idea that even if a sale is conducted within one state, that the market transcends the state borders. Is that at least roughly right?
Well, when very recently, Lopez has a number of progeny. And the most recent one is a case called Gonzalez v. Raich, which is a case that looked at medical marijuana law and basically said the federal government has the power to tell states that they may not decriminalize marijuana. And they looked at it essentially as a matter of this commodity, even if you're growing it in your own backyard for commercial consumption, is, an economic commodity that affects the marketplace, even if it never makes it into the marketplace. So, yes, in that sense, the idea is that, you know, drugs are this economic commodity, and therefore they are within the commerce power of the federal government to regulate. Does that answer your question? Or?
Well, it's my question was sort of extending from that. It seems to me like that's like the ability to simply affect a market in kind of a vague and, you know, not so clearly defined way seems like a pretty different thing than the three items listed on that slide, like the, you know, the very specific and the way that you were talking earlier about sort of the slippery slope argument, as far as the idea is like, is the use of the internet a significant part of the commission of the crime? And so I'm curious whether there's been sort of a bit of a pendulum in terms of how credible the concept of applying interstate commerce is with between the federalist and states' rights.
Well, if you're still talking about the drug context, I think a lot of people were surprised by the Raich case and its outcome, not so much as a matter of drug policy, but as a matter of Commerce Clause jurisprudence, because the court had been moving very clearly in the direction of saying that in these third categories, where we're talking not about channels or instrumentalities, but we're talking about just sort of catch-all crime, where we have to show a substantial relation to commerce, that the Supreme Court had been in the process of really narrowing federal jurisdiction and saying, and generally favoring the states over the federal government. And Gonzalez v. Raich did not take that view. It allowed the federal government to assert its authority. And there are a number of scholars in the federalist camp who are very much states' rights advocates who, you know, at the time said, this is the death knell of federalism. The court is moving away from federalism. We'll see, because there are all sorts of new ways that it pops up all the time. Just this, at the end of this term, the Supreme Court just decided a case called Bond, in which for the first time they allowed individual criminal defendants to assert a 10th Amendment argument, saying that the state was the one that should have the power to prosecute, not the federal government in a particular case. This opens up a huge new area of litigation in federal criminal cases. And, you know, if I were a defense lawyer, I'd be working on my bond motions in every federal case I have right now and see where that goes now that, you know, the argument had been that only states could raise that argument in court. And now the Supreme Court has said, no, individual defendants can raise this argument. So just as Lopez created a floodgate of Commerce Clause litigation in federal criminal cases, Bond is certain to create litigation. Where that will go, nobody really knows. But the court, in saying that individuals have standing to raise this claim, obviously is interested in hearing those cases. They have to know that they're going to be getting them. So, yes, Oliver.
A kind of a comment and a question that follows it. One of the things that it will help the development of the Internet, not that it needs that much help in a sense, but certainly helped it at along the way, is the creation of a notion of safety for users, whether that's safety about their data, safety about who they're going to interact with, and among, as we look particularly at the young, as parents, having a notion that there's some policing going on is a comforting thing. That said, as we hear here, that at least under its most broadly interpreted view, almost whether it's the internet, telephone, getting on the roads, all of these things could be subject to the same a logic, but not necessarily the same justification. And you've said that drawing lines is a kind of a prudential matter rather than necessarily an absolute matter in this kind of thing. Where would you draw lines? Where would you draw lines? How would you redraft this statute? Do you think it's appropriate that it includes the telephone? Do you think it's appropriate it might include the roads and the mails? You've made, I think, a quite persuasive argument that particularly in the Jakes case, the use of these of internet and Twitter and things like that were central to the crime itself and perhaps appropriately treated in a federal matter. But where are the boundaries and how should they be drawn?
To some extent, I think you have to trust in the system to shake that out sort of at a more localized level, in the sense that, you know, you can't address every eventuality when you draft a statute. And the use of broad language, such as instrumentality of interstate commerce, is inevitable. You know, I don't think that you can legislate particular cases, but what you can do is have judicial review of particular cases. And we've talked to some extent about the idea that, you know, the Supreme Court has come up with these categories. If something fits into a category, I think it's appropriate to federalize it, and then you have to add on prosecutorial discretion and not reaching out to minor cases that don't involve significant usage of the facility. And then the courts are ultimately there as a check. And I haven't really sort of gotten into the nitty-gritty of how this works in practice. But the idea is that courts have essentially held that there's something that I call the federal nexus requirement that gets grafted on to a charge, in that it has to be pleaded in the indictment. And this is sort of a matter of criminal practice in the courtroom. It has to be pleaded in the indictment. It has to be proved up to the jury. And it ultimately gets vetted by courts that look at these as applied challenges. And then it gets included in jury instructions, so that jurors are required to find that the internet or other telecommunications facilities were used in commission or in furtherance of the commission of the crime. And I do have some language from some of the opinions. Let me just see if I can find it without too much trouble. Okay, so for example, here's a court, and this court is one of the federal district courts that's looked at this issue in a case called Augustine, and it talks about how the plain language of the amendment requires more than an incidental use of a telephone to satisfy the jurisdictional element. Rather, the instrumentality must have been used in committing or in furtherance of the offense. This, in the court's opinion, requires more than a mere incidental use. And the court goes on to talk specifically about the nature of the usage and how central it was to the crime that was committed. So there really is a mechanism sort of there in the bushes, you know, there in the details that allows this to get filtered out in individual cases. And I don't think that really is such a problem as long as you're not seeing overreaching. And given that this amendment was made in 2006, there are only three reported cases on it to date. It's very difficult to get specific information on federal kidnapping charges generally, how many people are charged. You can't find that because kidnapping is such a broad term, and there are many federal statutes that criminalize different types of kidnapping. It's not collected together in any one place because I did try to figure out how often is this statute being used. As far as I can figure out, it's only been used a few times since the amendment was made, you know, in terms of the internet-based jurisdiction. Yes?
Cases?
No, because that's a separate statute. And I haven't really looked at the federal parental kidnapping statute recently, but if it does have one of this sort of instrumentalities provisions, I think I would have seen that in my research. So that's a separate statute. Those are not prosecuted under 1201A. Yeah.
Interesting. I really like the Jake's case as your example because I think it's really telling that it's the use of the internet was so central, as you argue, but it's also still a familial abuse case, which I think is interesting just for purposes of people understanding that it's not really just the big bad guy on the outside that you have to worry about who's using the internet in this way to get at your kids, but that it's also, this is a stepfather, a step-uncle,
right.
Someone
right.
In the home.
Yeah, that's that's an interesting
point. I also think that it's going off on a couple points that were made here, really important to keep in mind when you're kind of talking about this issue and writing about this issue to think, to not necessarily just focus on the idea that federal resources are better applied this way, because so my background, I was a federal prosecutor for a number of years under both the Clinton and Bush administrations, and under the Bush administration, I did child exploitation cases. So I had a lot of experience doing child pornography cases, which rely on sort of all prongs of Lopez, but including the instrumentalities idea. And while I think on the one hand it's easy to say federal resources are better applied this way, and federal investigators have a better ability to handle many of these kinds of cases, it's also really important, the point that it was made here, that state resources really do need to be brought up to par because the feds cannot possibly handle all of the cases that they would need to handle, at least under, like, say, the child pornography laws, which they don't. I mean, the state's child pornography, for people who don't know, is prosecuted both at the state and federal level. So I would just be wary as a former prosecutor of saying too much that, you know, the federal government is uniquely positioned to handle this and should be the one handling it and regulating it. I kind of think you have to have a double approach to it.
Well, and you
otherwise
do.
Otherwise, you're going to overwhelm.
Right.
Everyone, which
and,
I don't
and,
think
and
you're
you
not
do.
Saying.
And nothing is sort of saying that you dispossess the states of their jurisdiction, but simply that federal prosecution should be allowed. And I don't mean to say that only federal prosecution should be allowed. And that's not what the statute does. But just to sort of throw it back to you, because that's really interesting, what sort of intake guidelines were applied to decide whether something should be prosecuted at the federal or state level?
I was thinking about that. At the time that I was handling the cases, it was sort of, you know, if the United States Postal Inspection Service or the FBI or the ICE, at the time, Customs, brings the case to you, you kind of do it, because this was under Ashcroft. It was under a different administration. And it was also really at the beginning of child pornography cases being found and proliferating over the internet and being prosecuted that way. As things progressed, and certainly by the time that I left and after I left, the people who followed me started to have much more limited ability to handle the number of cases that were coming in. And so they started being had to be much choosier about what they would do, and they started applying bigger standards. Interestingly, though, the standards had less to do about how central the internet was to the commission, in part because in child pornography, what you're talking about is contraband going over the internet. It's a little bit different. It's not just a communication. It's actually the contraband itself is being communicated that way. So the person who followed me, I've heard her say that she would really only take cases if they involve videos of infants and toddlers being raped, or you know, people with very large collections or with bad histories of other kinds of sex crimes before they would take the case federally as opposed to having the state prosecute it. But at the time that I did it, it was really sort of luck of the draw, who caught who. Did the FBI catch you, or did the local police catch you?
Yeah, and I do think that there are so many different policies that come into play that it's sort of hard to come up with any unified theory of how the federal government chooses which cases to prosecute. One thing that's controversial in the Jakes case, as I mentioned briefly, is this issue of the death penalty. This folds into a huge issue under Ashcroft, which was the change in the federal death penalty protocol between the Clinton and Bush administrations, where previously there were numerous changes made to it, one of which was that previously local offices could make their own determinations about whether or not to seek death where it was an available penalty. So, for example, I worked in Brooklyn, and in the 8 years I was in the office, I can think of maybe two cases where the office sought the death penalty, whereas offices in Texas and Florida were routinely seeking the death penalty. Ashcroft believed that was inappropriate, that there should be such a variation between local offices, and he sought to require, essentially, as I understand it, and I was gone by then, but to require prosecutors to go through the death penalty protocol in any case where death was an available penalty. And that had huge repercussions within the Justice Department. But in the Jakes case, the death penalty protocol under Clinton had specifically prohibited bringing a federal prosecution because death was not an available penalty in the state. That provision was removed under Ashcroft when is no longer part of the federal death penalty protocol. And now you get the sense that the lack of availability of death as a penalty in a state may be a consideration in deciding whether or not to bring a federal prosecution.
With regard to stiffer sentences, right? So a lot of times if the reason that you're looking for the person with the bigger collection of child pornography or the worst history of sex crimes or, you know, the worst images is because the federal government has very high mandatory minimum sentences for child pornography crimes, and the states don't typically. So you're making a decision that those are the people you want to prosecute because they're deserving of higher sentences, basically.
I think we have time for maybe one more question. Yeah.
How common is it to, or can you, and how common is it to prosecute for attempt or conspiracy? Because I can imagine cases where you've done the internet aspect of this, but haven't actually affected the kidnapping, in which case now you're targeting something that's more like speech.
I have not seen any prosecutions for attempt under this amended statute. However, there are other contexts in which attempt is what is the more normal charge, and that would be there's a statute that prohibits use of interstate commerce facilities to sexually entice a minor. In other words, like essentially to contact somebody online who's posing, usually it's law enforcement. I mean, the vast majority of these are law enforcement, posing as, you know, a 12-year-old girl. And all of the arrangements are made, you know, in detail, and often there are multiple communications that get very explicit. And then the defendant shows up to a location, and the person that he meets is an FBI agent or another federal law enforcement agent, and there never was a 12-year-old girl involved. And so in that context, attempt is generally the charge, and that is quite common.
So when they don't necessarily even go to the location, but where they've just taken a substantial step, like purchasing the airline ticket, they don't necessarily have to have left their state or left their location.
Right.
Or the attempt.
Well, so I was told we should end in time to turn over the room by 1:45.
Exactly.
So.
Well, thank you so much, and that does give us a minute.
Thank you.